Hey, you! You're listening to Funny and Handsome Guys, brought to you by Centers of Attention Studios. Why don't you give us some feedback at 847-893-0344 and leave us a voicemail, or Twitter us at FHGPodcast, or email us FHGPodcast@gmail.com. Best responses may or may not be made fun of on the air, so fair warning. Enjoy the show.
Yay!
Welcome back! It's Funny and Handsome Guys!
Hooray!
Hooray! I'm Kevin.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Reggie.
That was almost flawless, guys. We're getting to be professionals at this.
Yes, we're getting good at this.
We're your weekly pop culture, news, comics, movies, music. We're everything to everyone. And we're awesome.
And nothing at,
it. At
the same time.
Yes. So yeah, we're the Funny and Handsome Guys. Very often we're one or the other or neither. And this week we'll figure out what we are. We got a pretty good show tonight. Got our album review of the week. We're going to be discussing Bloc Party's new album, 4. It's the first album since their last Intimacy. Was that in 2008 or 2009, Chris?
It's been 4 years.
Okay, well, that would make sense.
So, oh wait.
Yes. And then we're going to follow that up. We're going to talk about Wizard World. It's a Chicago comic convention, pop culture convention, heavily on the pop culture side of things. Been going on for quite a while now, and Reggie and I visited that this last week, and then we're going to close it up with our list of the week, our top 5 team-ups, inspired by the brief news of Ben Affleck being offered to direct the Justice League movie, which some people could think of it as being a great team-up, some people could think of it as a WTF team-up. We're going to talk about our dream team-ups. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to what you guys have got to say about that.
Well, to be clear, Kevin, it's not our dream team-ups like things that we wish we would have, right? It's team-ups that have actually happened.
I thought we were going with possible team-ups.
Okay. See, I went with actual team-ups.
You guys both...
So did I.
Son of a bitch!
It's fine.
I suck.
We'll make do with what you got, Kevin.
Okay, you know what? That's the list. That's what it is. We wing it pretty much every week anyway.
We left it open to interpretation.
Yeah. I said, what team-ups would you like to see?
That's funny, because neither of us took it that way.
Yeah. I specifically said, what team... It's all right, though. That's okay. I'm not going to even worry about it. We'll just go with... Yeah.
That's awesome that you're the odd man out now, because because we don't know how to read.
Clearly.
Well, obviously, like, my explanation in our pre-show email we do every week was not very good, even though I said specifically, what team-ups would you like to see? It's okay. No, for real though, it'll be fun. I'll be definitely interested to see what team ups you guys actually have really liked that have come out recently. So, anyway, first up though is Bloc Party's new album 4. Let's listen to a track from that. Reggie, do you have a track that you would like to choose for this one?
Yeah, actually, I'd like to hear a little bit of Truth.
The truth that fell from his lips, it blinded us, and in the darkness left. So I am yours now. respectfully. I am yours now, truthfully.
Truth by Block Party. Chris, what did you think about this? I know that you and I saw them at Lollapalooza here a few years back. I don't know if they've been to Lollapalooza since then because they've taken this hiatus.
Yeah, they were there this past year.
Oh, yes, they were this past year. So you've seen them both at the beginning and the end of their hiatus.
Yes, technically speaking. And there was a sort of world of difference in their live shows, by the way, at the two different Lollapalooza performances. The first one
imagine.
I thought was a little not so good.
No,
but
a lot of frat boys
latest
really
one
loved,
was
loved
actually
that
quite
one.
Good. But that being said, they did play a couple new songs off their album 4, which is, you know, their fourth album, and it's also. They have four members in their band, and it's been 4 years since their previous album. So really, there's a lot of significance to the word four. There's also a song on the album called Day Four. So
there's really
four,
absolutely no reason
things.
For four. They just like the number four.
Clearly, yes. They just like the number four. And what's interesting is that this album almost didn't happen, or maybe things were not as nearly as bad as they were reported, because the band was sort of separated for a while. Kele Okereke, I think that's how you pronounce his last name.
I think so.
He did a solo project while he was sort of on a break from the band. And one day, as he was hanging out, he saw one of the guys in the band walk right past him while he was out at this restaurant. So he yelled out to the guy in the band, and he didn't hear him. So he followed the guy, and he found him meeting up with the other guys in the band. And they all went into this practice space, and his phone did not ring. Kayla's phone did not ring, and he was like, "So have they kicked me out of the band? I don't know what's going on." So basically what wound up happening was the couple of the band members came out and said, "Well, you know, since Kayla's off busy doing his own thing, we wanted to get together and make some new music, whether that's instrumental stuff or with a new singer. We have yet to determine that." Anyway, after the news was reported like a day later, posted on Block Party's website, it said, "Oh, there is no, you know, change in band lineup. Block Party is still Block Party, etc., etc." And sure enough, about a year later, we have this new album, 4, which is sort of their return, but it's sort of a different sort of Block Party than where we left them. Intimacy, their last album, was very electronic in nature. They tried to incorporate a lot of those elements into their sound, away from the dance rock a little bit, a little less rock, a little more dance, and that didn't work out so well for them. This time, they've pretty much gotten rid of all the dance and just brought in the rock. And it's sort of like Block Party have gone all alternative rock in a lot of ways. It sounds like records you would hear from the 90s, albums that I actually grew up listening to, you know, records from Soundgarden,
Smashing Pumpkins.
There's even like the song Coliseum sounds like it's sort of blatantly riffing on Days of the New. Do you remember Days of the New?
You guys? I do.
Their big song Touch Peel Stand was a hit.
I think that was the only song I had. It was one of the first MP3s I got way back in the day, back when I was in high school, over 10 years ago. Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, I was actually obsessed with Days of the New for, like, their first two records. But that's a whole other topic. The point being that Bloc Party sound like a different band here, but they also sound like the same band in some ways. They've gotten a lot harder in the rock arena. They've gotten heavier, but they've also got some of those more tender moments still. So you've got something heavier and unhinged, like a song 3x3, which is really, you know, muscular. And Kaylee's vocals just really hit on point in a lot of ways. But then, you know, you've got some lighter moments, some songs that are a little quieter, speak to their ballads. You know, their biggest ballad was This Modern Love, was sort of their big hit. And there are a couple tracks on the album that are almost sort of evoke those same sorts of memories. So it's an interesting dichotomy. It's almost like they're bipolar in some sense, because they get really heavy on some tracks, and then they're really sort of tender and soft on other tracks. And on a whole, I think that imbalance doesn't speak well to the record as a whole. I think it kind of messes with Bloc Party. And given the fact that, sure, the dance rock craze is pretty much over, and Bloc Party was one of the big bands that sort of brought that to light. And dance rock has kind of gone away, and it's more dance now than anything else. You got your dubstep. And they didn't go dubstep, even though Muse is going dubstep for their new album.
That's what I hear.
Yeah, so that's a scary proposition in itself.
Well, but at least they're not going further into Radiohead territory. So, I mean, that may differentiate them.
Potentially.
But
as for Bloc Party, I mean, I think that when they were doing, like, their first album, Silent Alarm, was really good because not only was it danceable, but it had some really, really good guitar parts. And I think that a lot of the guitar parts on 4 are wasted just with sort of general chords and heaviness instead of actual, you know, precision and solos, which I think is part of the album's issues.
I'm curious, Reggie, have you ever heard Bloc Party before? I'm no expert by any means. I guess intimacy must have come and gone without my knowledge, because I haven't even heard of it before tonight, to be honest. But I really like Helicopter. I really like Hunting for Witches. And I still remember, like, those songs. I believe all of them are on my iPod right now. But yeah, I guess intimacy just didn't make a big splash.
Intimacy is interesting, because that was the one where I actually came in to start listening to them. And so that was sort of like my original introduction to Bloc Party. And so when I started listening to their earlier stuff, A Weekend in the City and Silent Alarms, it was quite a bit different. And this again is this album is quite a bit different from Intimacy. It's interesting, because I feel like this album, really, they're trying to strip everything down. They're sort of going in not just a different direction, but like the clear opposite direction of Intimacy. They're taking everything, they're stripping everything down to much more of a not quite lo-fi. It's not a lo-fi cash-in. It's much more of just a sort of old-school, almost garage rock. It reminds me a lot of some of the local bands in the area that have had better productions. Not to say that they're amateurish or anything, but they do have sort of this feel to some of their songs, which not quite as overproduced as some of their prior albums have been. Not that their prior albums have been overproduced, but you could maybe levy that argument towards Intimacy.
Well, you know, and the sort of they have a bunch of sounds of the studio that they put on, tack on
exactly.
The beginnings and ends of these tracks that really kind of gives it, emphasizes that feel a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, like, I'm not quite sure where this fits in the Bloc Party discography or whatever. It's certainly a new effort from them. I'm going to go out and say that it's not a great effort. Like, I don't think this is by any means their best album. But it's definitely an interesting course correction from Intimacy, and I hope that they keep up with this and keep making music past this. Perhaps they were getting a little bit too big for the britches after up to Intimacy, and that's why they they had to take some time off. And I can never pronounce the lead singer's name.
Just call him Kayleigh.
Kayleigh. Okay, there we go. Kayleigh. Maybe he was pulling too much of the rock star attitude, and that's why. I mean, one can only assume and make conjectures towards it. But really, this is the project of a band that's sort of trying to distill things down and refine their footing. But there are some really good highlights on the album, though. I really enjoy Kettling.
Yes, yeah, definitely that one. I like that one a lot.
Yeah, and actually, why don't we go ahead and listen to the opening of that, just because I want to show something here. Okay, so this opening is sort of like what I'm talking about, where they're breaking things down a little bit, making it much more distilled into a harder rock, more garage rock type of thing. And Chris, you were talking about the prior influences of Soundgarden and I mentioned Smashing Pumpkins. Like this is what I heard, and I was like, Smashing Pumpkins. Like, it just sort of reaches up at you as a sort of 90s metal rock. Which is not a bad thing in my opinion, but the whole of the album is not as strong as the opening of this song.
I like that. The album to me, since I was a little familiar with Bloc Party, I felt like it, like you guys have already said, it sounded like them. I mean, there were things that differed from track to track, but Kettling was the first song that made me perk up and say, ooh, you know. There were a couple of others later on in the album, but
and that's part of the problem. Like, Kettling doesn't happen until you're almost halfway through the album, and it happens too few and far between, you know?
You know, the single is Octopus, and I feel it falls in a lot with the rest of the record in the sense of that it's not particularly memorable, and that's sort of one of the big issues, even though I do think that's probably the one track that sounds most like some of their older stuff.
Oh, certainly.
To almost inspire people to keep listening.
I agree, and I don't think it's I don't think that song Octopus is bad or anything, and I definitely think it is more of a return to their roots than some other songs on here are, and it's definitely, I think, a not memorable. Like you're right, it's sort of almost generic, I guess, in like it's a generic block party song to me almost, and that's not necessarily a bad thing because I enjoy block party, but they had other options, I thought, and it'll be interesting to see how they follow it up. I think that's really what it comes down for me.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's going to be fascinating to see where they choose to go from here, so long as they do choose to go from here, because especially given the shifts that they kind of made in some of the songs, whether or not they're going to continue to pursue something a little bit harder, whether they're going to backtrack on that, what they're going to, or maybe try something else entirely, who knows?
Reggie, what are your final thoughts?
My final thoughts is that it's an okay album. It's not one that I think I would buy in entirety. I know if any of the songs, I'll probably get like Kettling. I'll probably get like Truth. There's another really good. It's the last track actually. It's called We Are Not Good People. That one I really liked too. So I think those are the standouts to me. Those are the ones that I'd like to own potentially, but the rest of it I could leave behind.
All right. Well, 4 is currently released. You can get it. Is it streaming anywhere?
It's streaming on Block Party's website.
There you go. So you can currently stream it on Block Party's website and check it out further. And if you like it, pick it up. If not, drop us a note and let us know what you think one way or the other. Anyway, so this last weekend, Reggie and I were both at Wizard World. As I was saying before, it's Chicago's one of the two big Chicago comic conventions, the other one being C2E2, which Reggie and I mentioned earlier in the show, in, I believe, our first show, right?
Yeah, it was our first show.
Right. So this is sort of a return for us. We're going back to another comic convention. It's a very different comic convention, though, than C2E2. Whereas C2E2 has a big emphasis on the comics, has a big emphasis on the programming. Like, there's tons of programming. Wizard World places much more of an emphasis on the pop culture side of things. As an example, The Situation was originally scheduled. He ended up not being able to come because of issues.
I do want to say that I don't think The Situation has ever not been able to come.
Oh! I don't even know what that means, man.
Well, people with their minds in the gutter will get that.
I'm sure. But there were quite a few of other celebrities there. There was a lot of emphasis on the celebrities that show up, the various photo ops that you can get. They had whole sections. The entire middle section of the floor was devoted to these signatures and who you could go visit and whatnot. And then they had a side area where you could go for photo ops. I've been to enough comic conventions. I'm not a huge fan of waiting in line to see whatever usually B-list, C-list, or D-list celebrity is there.
Hold on. I would not consider Bruce Campbell to be anything below A-list.
No. I'm totally like supportive of Bruce Campbell. I love Bruce Campbell. For the record, Evil Dead was the movie that made me want to like make movies. And Army of Darkness, like, was one of the movies that gave me, like, a desire to make all my movies really sarcastic. But you also have other big names, quote-unquote big names. Stan Lee is there, who is a big name. And you get people like CM Punk, who is... I'm not quite sure why WWE stars are there. It's probably the same reason why WWE is on the Sci-Fi Channel, or the Sci-Fi Channel, whatever you want to pronounce it as. But you also have actors like Dean Cain and Lauren Holly. Tom Felton, who played Draco in Harry Potter. James Marsters, who was Angel in... Or not Angel.
He was Spike on Buffy.
Spike, yes, thank you. I don't watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It's a big hole in my nerd credentials. But, Reggie, you were there on other, for other reasons. You actually were there with your comic book, Saints. So you have probably a pretty different, experience, compared to what I had.
I did, but I didn't. I spent all weekend at the table, but I did, steal away to a few panels. I did get a chance to meet some people, and I did have a couple of interesting encounters too. So even though I was there on business, there was a little bit of pleasure sprinkled in there too.
Anybody who did you meet that anybody we would know?
That
you want to throw out there?
I guess this is a little bit of a coming out party for me, in a sense, because it's not that I'm ashamed of it. It's just it's hard to bring it up in conversation. But I, on and off my entire life, I've watched wrestling.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with that, man. One of my best friends growing up, like, and I say growing up, I mean like from the ages of like 5 to 7. He ended up going to wrestling college in Europe, which apparently they have. It's apparently a thing to go to wrestling college in Europe. But more power to you.
There was one day the Bella Twins, I don't know if you guys are familiar, but the Bella Twins walked past my table, and I got to say hi to them, and they're both, I mean, not only are they beautiful, there's two of them, so that helps. John Morrison, or John Hennigan now, because he quit WWE and he can't go by that name anymore. I got to talk to him because he was randomly by the table. If you could see my various tumblers, you would know that CM Punk is probably my favorite person in the world. So I got to meet him. I got to ask him a question at his panel, and there's videos of it on YouTube that we will not link to. So don't look for that in the companion posts, because I was super nervous and I sounded really I just sounded like a scared chipmunk.
I say boo to that.
Should throw it out there. Okay, well, Reggie, why do you like wrestling? Maybe we should go down this pathway here, because I'll admit, like, I definitely went through a period of my life where I really enjoyed wrestling, but I was also like 11 years old, 12 years old. But I have quite a few friends. A friend I know who's a comic book owner in Chicago. I'm not sure if he listens to this show or not, but he's also a big fan of CM Punk, and so you're not alone. I actually know quite a few people. Former host, co-host of the show, Alfonso, was actually a huge fan of wrestling. So, I mean, he definitely went more towards the MMA type fighting currently, but he also grew up with the wrestling. He really enjoyed wrestling as well. So Reggie, why do you enjoy wrestling? And maybe you can fill me in why wrestlers were at this particular convention.
I think in the case of somebody like CM Punk, CM Punk is so smart and universal that, I mean, if you follow him on Twitter, all he tweets about is comics pretty much. He's friends with, what is her name? Jill Thompson. Jill Thompson, yes. She actually designed Daniel Bryan's ring gear.
Jill Thompson being, the American comic book writer.
Artist.
Well, yeah, she's an illustrator as well. But she's also, I believe she's also a writer. But she's, yeah, primarily known as an artist.
Yeah. It's not exclusive. It's, for me, it's all entertainment. Like a lot of people, there's a pocket Tumblr community where a lot of people compare John Cena and CM Punk to Superman and Batman. Cena is very much the, you know, pretty boy poster boy, you know, will smile and take a picture with your baby with the thumbs up. And CM Punk is definitely more, like, real and gritty and raw and just, let's go and do it, you know, for revenge, for justice. Yeah, you know? And I think that's why I'm more of a CM Punk fan.
Well, I suppose that would make good sense then. Like, you've got John Cena and CM Punk who are contributing to sort of a larger serialized entertainment, which I think would appeal to comic book fans.
Because they're playing characters. They're being personas, you know? Just like how Superman and Batman, like Clark Kent. You know, like, these are people, these are names, you know. Sure, at the end of the day, Phil Brooks lays down his head and is just a man like any other, but CM Punk is somebody that's larger than life and always will be. Just in my opinion. I know, Chris, you're probably, like, laughing, and you're like, oh, what's wrong with this guy? But, you know, it's just, when you hear Hulk Hogan, you know, you picture the shirt ripping. I mean, how is that any different than Wolverine going schnicked and claws coming out of his fists, you know?
That's actually a really good example there, I think. Chris, have you ever had any wrestling fandom phases?
No, never in my life. I feel like the fakeness of it. I mean, well, it's not, you know, fake. Obviously, if you get hit in the back with a chair, you're actually getting hit in the back with the chair. But the staging of it is not something that I've particularly been fond of. But I did appreciate The Wrestler, the Mickey Rourke film, for all that it had to offer, which was a better inside look at sort of the wrestling industry, even though it wasn't, you know, on the level of like a WWE. So I do have some respect for wrestling and people that do enjoy wrestling.
And I do know it's fake, guys. I'm aware.
I don't think that prevents anybody from enjoying it anymore. I think most people who watch it these days are aware that it's choreographed, that are aware that the dramas that take place on the show are all written and scripted out well in advance. Most of these guys are probably buddies with each other and then get on the show and are mortal enemies, you know?
But that's what I like so much about CM Punk, is he was able to blur that line. His contract was up. I still don't know to this day if it was really up or if this is just, you know, if this is a work. But there was one night he came out. It was like John Cena and somebody else. CM Punk comes out and just messes stuff up. Then he grabs the microphone, walks to the top of the stage, and just sits Indian style and just starts speaking his mind about Vince McMahon, about the company, about everything they're doing. And it made me drop my jaw.
Uh,
I've heard a lot about CM Punk in, through the years. So, like, he's definitely a personality that is interesting to me. But I guess that's getting away from the Wizard World discussion a little bit. There are a lot of personalities that are here. I actually did stop by Reggie's booth a couple times, which is enjoyable meeting people behind the scenes with, you know, seeing Reggie there. I also got to see a couple of my old friends, Chris and Ann, who do the online web series Once Upon a Time in 1972. They've done a sequel, Once Upon a Time in 1973, and they're about to film Once Upon a Time in 1977, and then they're going to be doing a feature. But those are the people that I really like meeting at these conventions are the small-time artists, people who are putting together their stuff and getting there and are very passionate about it. Wizard World's interesting, though, for me, because there is much more of a flea market slash swap meet sort of experience to it. Reggie, would you feel like that's a fair assessment?
Well, Wizard World is kind of the redheaded stepchild. I know we've talked about this before, but it's because they don't have any industry support. Well, they don't have any major industry support, I should say.
Yeah, Marvel and DC have both pulled out of them. And I think most of the, like, Image and whatnot, of like, they're all imprints of Marvel and DC or have some sort of, like, connection to them, so...
So in a sense, that's all they really have to rely on is, you know, like the celebrities and then like, yeah, people in Artist Alley, you know, like you were just talking about, Kevin.
Yeah. It's interesting though. This is the first year, well, not the first year, but last year they didn't have any programming, and this year they actually had a little more programming. Like,
no, they had programming last year. It was just. It's really sad because it's mostly last year on Saturday programming was like Star Trek all day. Like that's all it was because that's, you know, all they had there. This year it was more varied. Another panel I got to go to was, Sam Trammell from True Blood. I got to, go to his Q&A session and I actually got to ask him a question too, which was really cool.
That's exciting.
Is that on YouTube too?
That one I wasn't so excited about because Sam, I mean, I like True Blood, but there are other characters, there are other actors in the show that I would be more excited about meeting. It was honestly something that was just on my mind, and so that's why I went up and asked. That was pretty much it.
Wizards, fairly interesting because they were formerly a magazine that spoke about comic books behind the scenes, and then a few years ago the magazine ceased to be, and it was only Wizard World, and that was all that was left of the company. They also had Toy Wiz, which was a
Toy Fair
website. Toy Fair, yes. They had Toy Fair, which was a magazine about toys that was much more aimed at like adults who collected action figures and whatnot. So it's interesting to see some of the backlash to them over the past few years, especially with C2E2 coming up. At least to me, it looked like they were doing just fine as far as as far as people go. Like there are going to be plenty of people that continue to go to this convention over the years. But I'm going to be very interested to see how they establish themselves over the next few years as a separate convention to C2E2.
It was definitely a lot bigger this year. It seemed like a lot more people were there. And like I said about C2E2, how the cosplay game was on point, the cosplayers at Wizard World this year knocked it out of the park.
Yeah, there were some pretty fantastic cosplayers at, which was interesting because I didn't expect it to be quite as many as people cosplaying as there were.
And I mean, the best part about it is there were some really obscure costumes, but
that's always the best part.
The nerve to be really good. Like, you know, that's the thing is if you're going to do it and it's not a character that maybe somebody will recognize readily, like they like every piece of like if I were to tell you guys that I saw a girl that was Party Poison from My Chemical Romance from the videos, that's like Gerard's alter ego for that album. She had the jacket, she had the helmet. I don't know if she had the gun, but because she walked by really quick. But I was like, oh my god, that's Party Poison. I don't think anybody else for like maybe a 30, 40 foot radius would probably recognize her. But to me, I was like, holy crap.
That's definitely interesting. I mean, My Chemical Romance, what's his name? He went on to do a...
Yeah, Gerard Umbrella Academy, that is an excellent... The first one, I had so many questions, and then the second one, like, it dragged until, like, the last issue, and I was just like, oh my god! Like, it was so good.
You see, I've actually heard... you know, I had actually heard that it was not very good when it first came out. Like, that's what I initially heard, that it wasn't very good. But I believe it won an Eisner.
It should have. I mean, I think the reason people said that is because a lot goes on, and then it just ends. Like, it's just like this, it's like you shake up a soda bottle, and then you screw the cap on really, really quick, and then say, all right, kids, wait for the second story arc, you know?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and say that I enjoy comics that are more limited in their story scope. I was actually just discussing this with Lindsay. We just picked up Revival issue 2. We got issue 1 while we were at Wizard World. It's a new series written by Hacken Tim Seeley and Mike Norton of Battle Pug fame. And we were both looking very forward to this comic, primarily because of the two of them. They're excellent artists. They're both Chicago-born, or I don't know if they're Chicago-born, but they're Chicago-based artists and writer who are... Everything that they've done so far has been pretty fantastic, and so to see the two of them team up on something, we were looking forward to it. And I'm not sure, though, if Revival is a limited series or not. It's definitely one of those series that sort of is setting itself up to be like, there are a lot of questions about what's going on, what's happening, like, how is this all going to get resolved? Is it going to get resolved? And so I guess that's going to be my big question with a series like that is, can you maintain those questions going on and not having a clear end in sight? Whereas something like Why the Last Man, which is quite possibly my favorite comic book of all time, was always meant to be a finite series, a series with a very clear end. And it went on for quite a while. I believe it's something like 10 trades that are out. But well worth the time and effort to get through it. Anyway, so anything that you want to point our direction in, Reggie, before we go for this this portion of the show?
I got to see the tail end of the costume contest because it ran concurrently with the CM Punk panel. But like I already said, the cosplayers were on point, and the actually, two people won Best in Show, and I want to assume it was the father and a daughter, but the dad was kick-ass, and this little 3 or 4 year old girl was Hit Girl, and she pulled it off so well. I mean, I was kind of mortified that an actual little girl was being Hit Girl, you know, based on the fact that her character, what she did to other human beings and what came out of her mouth in that movie was ridiculous, but she was really cute. And of course, you know, of course they would have let her win. And it was nice. It was nice.
Well, we'll have to see if we can find any links to pictures for them. I'm sure you can probably find that out there. Anyway, so that was Wizard World. And any new and upcoming comic conventions or otherwise big events that we go to, we'll definitely fill you in on what you might have missed in the future. So yeah, so the big news this past week, briefly at least, among certain circles, was that Ben Affleck was offered an opportunity to direct Justice League. Now, it's not clear whether he was actually offered it. He was just supposedly reading the script. Ben Affleck is well known for now for having written directed The Town. He's got the upcoming Argo coming out. He also did the really fantastic, in my opinion, Gone Baby Gone.
All three, the two that have been out so far have been really good.
Yeah, and I've always been a Ben Affleck apologist, so maybe this is why I was particularly interested by this news. Way back in 2007, he was in a little feature called Hollywoodland. He was really fantastic in. But even before that, when he was back in Kevin Smith's movies, Mallrats and Chasing Amy and Dogma, he was really good. And then Good Will Hunting came out, and everybody assumed that Matt Damon was the brains behind it. But really, as far as I've heard, Ben Affleck was the real, like, true writer behind it. He wrote a short film way back in the day called How I Killed My Lesbian Wife, Hung Her on a Meat Hook, and Now... Or I Killed My Lesbian Wife, Hung Her on a Meat Hook, and Now I Have a 3-picture deal at Disney, which was a student film. And that was available for a while on the website Adam Films. I don't even know if Adam Films is in existence anymore. But you could go and see that short way back in the day. And had a lot of promise. Like, and I really wanted to see him, like, return to behind the screen. And now that he's doing movies like Gone Baby Gone, it's certainly exciting to think that maybe he would be given the opportunity to do something like Justice League, which would be a big-budget superhero film, but you can tell that they want to go more in the Christopher Nolan style. And so for me, that's almost a dream team. And that came to me, like, where I decided that this week we should talk about our top five dream team team-ups. Now, the two of you guys
botched it like Sin Cara would.
I must not have communicated it well enough, and you guys have your favorite team-ups, which is just great. Like, I'm going to look forward to that as well. I personally... I'm focusing specifically on people that I really wish would get together with some other property or something or other, whether it's movies, music, film, comics, whatever. So that's where I'm coming from with my list. But let's start with one of you guys and one of your actual team ups. Reggie, what would be your number five team up?
My number five team up was the pairing of David Bowie and Queen, who came together and gave us the artistic gem known as Under Pressure.
Also, by proxy, Ice Ice Baby.
No. Nope. Nope. It was tried so hard not to mention that. I just love that song, and so it made my list, because David Bowie and Queen came together to make it. They teamed up, so to speak, and they did a damn fine job, in my opinion.
All right, excellent. Chris, what was your number five, top five team up?
My top five I composed based pretty much on acting performances in films. So it's basically great duos of films. And my number five pick is actually a tie. I actually have a tie for number five and a tie for number four. But the number five tie is both Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway as Bonnie and Clyde, and also Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy as Jesse and Celine in the both films Before Sunrise and Before Sunset. So I feel like one is they're both romances, but in completely opposite ways. Obviously, Bonnie and Clyde, well known for their criminal activity. So that's, they were in love for different sort of reasons than Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy, who are so impermanent, because the whole idea behind Before Sunrise and Before Sunset is that they only have a day to, you know, sort of talk and get those feelings through. And I feel like both are fascinating in their own ways. I feel like the Bonnie and Clyde pairing is classic, mostly because it happened way back, you know, 40 years ago. And the Before Sunrise, Before Sunset is something that's, you know, they're even talking about making a third one. And both films directed by Richard, both Before Sunrise and Before Sunset are directed by Richard Linklater. And they're talking about all three of them getting back together and doing a third one. So I'm excited to see what comes out of that. I think some great pairings all around there.
All right. Excellent. Those are both really good pairings there. Like I said, I went in a slightly different direction. I was picturing team-ups that I would love to see happen. And my number five is inspired by a current team-up that's going on that I really wish would be just slightly changed. And the original team-up is David Cronenberg and Robert Pattinson. And I don't necessarily have any issues with Robert Pattinson as an actor. Like, yeah, he's done a lot of shit. You know, I'd be perfectly honest. Like, his work in Twilight, pretty bland. But he wasn't bad in Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. He was actually pretty likable in that. And David Cronenberg is one of the, in my opinion, all-time great, you know, imagination-filled directors out there. Like, every film he does is very visionary, and in a way that Zack Snyder just hopes to be. But I right now, David Cronenberg and Robert Pattinson are working together, and it's just not working according to everybody. Basically, Cosmopolis is not apparently a really good movie, mainly because of Robert Pattinson, just not quite fitting the role. In my perfect world, I would have Joseph Gordon-Levitt in that position. He showed himself to be a really fantastic, more adult actor in recent works by Christopher Nolan. But he's been showing this for years. Like, he's probably one of our most accomplished young actors from movies like...
Have you ever seen Havoc?
Rick? What's that?
Have you ever seen Havoc?
Havoc? I have not seen that one, actually.
Havoc, he plays like this, it's funny, kind of funny, because it's him and Anne Hathaway, but they play like these, like, suburbanite wannabe gangster kids.
I remember it because it was the first movie where, Anne Hathaway, a lot of people were making big news over it because she apparently, went topless in it. Of course, right after that, she was in,
Brokeback Mountain.
So it was quickly made a moot point there, but
still, if you think that I missed it, I did not.
But he's been in movies like Mysterious Skin and Brick and Lookout, and these are fantastic movies, and he's just been a solid actor pretty much from the word go. And I don't know. I think that he's shown enough, like, darkness underneath his nice guy next door type of persona, which I would love to see him do something with David Cronenberg and sort of pull that and make it bring it out to the forefront a little bit more.
Great actor, great director, great team up, I would think.
Hopefully, that's the hope. Okay, so number four. Reggie, what's your number four?
My number four, it's Marvel Comics and a video game company that I've admired since I was in elementary school, would be Capcom. They have collaborated many, many times to make games that I enjoy. The first of which was Marvel Super Heroes, the first of which I'm confused. Well, anyway, they made an X-Men fighting game where you played as different members of the X-Men, different bad guys. And then they made a general one where you played as different Marvel characters and they threw in, like, Captain America and your Spider-Man. And then they have a series, just Marvel versus Capcom, where certain Marvel characters, like, you know, members of the X-Men, Spider-Man, Captain America, those guys will fight against, like, Ryu from Street Fighter, and they always throw in, like, a bunch of random entries that just for shock value, but they end up also being really fun. Like, this last one they had, Phoenix Wright from the Ace Attorney series. They threw in Amaterasu from Okami, which is a really I don't know what's the word I'm looking for. It's a game that people really like, but it's very underrated. So Marvel and Capcom would be my number four team up.
No, that's fantastic. I remember playing X-Men Children of the Atom way long time ago, which was an old Capcom X-Men game. And I believe I played it on Windows, like on an old Windows system.
Like an emulator?
No, they had an actual...
Oh, like a legit version?
Yeah, they had it on Windows. I was the weird kid who had all the PlayStation games and Sega Saturn games on my computer that for the random, like, not very popular ports of those games.
The PC versions of the actual...
Console
games. Yeah.
I didn't play Halo until it was on my computer. So, but yeah, no, that's an excellent pick.
I do want to say that back in the 90s, I would often, while wasting time between showings of, like, double features or whatever at the movie theater, I would head over to the arcade and they'd have Marvel versus Capcom. Marvel versus Capcom. I would play it all the time. Good fun.
Good pick. Chris, what's your number four?
All right. Continuing with my great sort of movie duos. My number four is also a tie. This is the last tie I have on this list. First up, John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson, otherwise known as Vincent Vega, and Jules Winfield in Pulp Fiction. Classic film, classic team-up, classic scene. That is a tasty burger, among other things. The other number four pick that I have is Woody Allen and Diane Keaton, both from Annie Hall and from Manhattan. Diane Keaton was Woody Allen's muse for a while, and she helped him to make two of his best films ever. So I'm a huge admirer of both those films, both the Woody Allen films and also Tarantino's Pulp Fiction. So that pretty much sums it up.
That's fantastic. I'm as my my inner film geek definitely approves of both of those team ups. So my number four in my possible team ups would be the writer Dave Eggers and the comic book character Plastic Man, who Plastic Man is not exactly the most well known. He's
actually he has a show coming out pretty soon.
He does. He's definitely a fun sort of character who has been around, and he's definitely a staple of the DC comics, but he's nowhere near like the sort of visible character as even someone like, you know, Flash or the Green Lantern or even the Green Arrow. You know, these characters are all much more visible than Plastic Man. And he's been around, and he's had his own little bits here and there. He had an old Saturday morning cartoon show. Is very much sort of a golden age superhero. And Dave Eggers, on the other hand, is a writer who came out onto the scene with his memoir, A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius. A lot of people call him sort of the ideal candidate for, like, the pretentious writer. I really like that book for the most part. It sort of goes off into this down this path where he starts talking about trying out for the real world MTV. But overall, it's a pretty fantastic book, and I believe it was on the short list for the Pulitzer Prize. He's done a few others since then. A couple years back, he did one called Zaytoon. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce it. It's about a Syrian-American owner of a painting and contracting company in New Orleans. I'm reading from Wikipedia here, but it takes place right after Hurricane Katrina. It's talking about terrorism and the current conditions of things. And I just thought that, like, taking somebody like Plastic Man, who has had, like, moments in DC where it's considered something of a darker, he's had his darker moments. I think somebody like Dave Eggers as a writer would be great in taking a character like Plastic Man and doing something brilliant with them. I'm not sure what they would end up doing, but I just have a feeling it would be brilliant. Much like Dave Eggers wrote the screenplay for Where the Wild Things Are for Spike Jonze, as well as the movie Away We Go, both of which were sort of bittersweet comedy, drama, tragedy. Not so much tragedy, but definitely comic drama type things. I thought Where the Wild Things Are was brilliant, if a bit beyond the ages of most of its audience, maybe. But yeah, so Plastic Man and Dave Eggers. Chris, or Reggie, get this in order here. Reggie, what's your number three?
Man, I was totally thrown for a loop because I was just thinking, like, man, that'd be really cool. Like, Orson Scott Card wrote Ultimate Iron Man, and I think that would be along that level.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Of somebody, you know, legendary doing. Anyway, I'm sorry. My number three pick is a small little company. You guys might have heard of it. It's called Disney.
I'm vaguely familiar of them. I sort of referenced them here just a minute ago in the title of a short film by Ben Affleck. I was just saying words, though, so I don't actually know who they are.
Well, I'm not sure either.
They're pretty obscure. And they actually... they had a partnership going. Well, now it's more permanent, but back in the day it wasn't. But they had a partnership with a little up and coming 3D animation studio called Pixar. And in, I believe it was 1995. I could totally be wrong. No, I'm pretty sure it was 95. A little movie called Toy Story came out, and my life as I knew it was completely changed. and they've collaborated a few more times, and yeah, I'd say their other collaborations aren't as earth-shattering as say Toy Story 1 was, but Toy Story 2 was amazing. Incredibles is one of my favorite movies. Up was an emotional bitch slap. Like I sat there, Caitlin and I, we had 3 miscarriages, and we did not expect that kind of thing to be addressed in a Pixar movie. And we were both like, in the first 5 minutes of the movie, we were both like, our eyes were welling up and we were like, okay, I'm ready to go.
I watched the first 5 minutes, or I watched the movie at my laptop, like sitting there in my bedroom, like just sort of like, oh, I'll watch this. I don't know. And I'm a cynic by nature. So I was like, I had heard the news about it, like, and of course, like, I've never really been disappointed by a Pixar movie. Cars is not going to be exactly my favorite movie of all time, but I don't think any of their movies are bad. And most of them are truly great. And this movie, like, that first 10 minutes of that movie, waterfalls, man, waterfalls.
Don't go chasing them.
Anyway, yeah, Toy Story, or Pixar and Disney, I don't think film would be anywhere near what it is right now without them, especially children film.
And, I mean, they have an army of imitators right now, too. And I like DreamWorks, but I kind of feel like they really try way too hard. And I think Pixar does a better job of, I mean, I have to scrounge for it, but I'm sure I can find it and throw in the companion notes. But there's the Pixar rules of storytelling, and like one of them is that attempts need to be lauded more than successes, you know, because they know that kids are going to be watching these movies, so it encourages them to go out and do stuff, you know, and try stuff. And it's like, yeah, it's not so much about the end result, but it's about growing as a person. And I think anytime that is the basis of what you do, like, I need to apply to you on that. So, my number three pick, Disney Pixar.
Good one. Chris, what's your number three?
My number three, they're on a mission from God. They are John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd in The Blues Brothers. Classic film. It was actually shown at Wrigley Field earlier this summer. And they attempted a Guinness Book of World Record thing where people had to wear shades at night for a certain amount of time. I don't know if they even succeeded. They probably did. But I did not go to that screening. Not because I don't love the film, because I do, and not because I don't think that it contains some of both John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd's best work on film. But I feel like going to an event such as that, I don't know, not always for me, but still a great, great film on its own. You don't need to see it, you know, projected at Wrigley Field to enjoy it by any means. And it's very Chicago-centric too, which is also fantastic.
One of the great Chicago movies.
Indeed.
So, my number three is Dumb Dumb Girls. And I was originally going to go with The Pretenders, but that may be a little bit too on the nose. So I'm going to go with Susie Sue. And the Banshees normally, but, yeah, Dumb Dumb Girls and Susie Sue. I'm a sucker for, like, old school, you know, goth pop along the lines of Susie Sue and Dead Can Dance and This Mortal Coil. I don't know why I like it. I just do. I can't explain it. And then Dumb Dumb Girls came out, a few years back with some really fantastic sort of dreamy lo-fi rock, which was just very intoxicating, if I may be so pretentious to call it that. I love their first album, their I Will Be, which was an album released back in, I believe it was 2010. But fantastic album. Their single J-La-La was fun and great. They had an EP, I don't remember which EP it was, but
He Gets Me High.
I believe that may be it. Yeah, He Gets Me High was pretty fantastic, and that was sort of a middle ground of I Will Be and their follow up Only in Dreams LP, which was a new sort of direction. It was a move away more from the noise pop, the dream pop type stuff that they had, the lo-fi sound of it all. It was much more produced at I don't want to say it was better produced or anything like that. It was just a more clean sounding album. But it was great, very heavily influenced by Susie Sue and The Pretenders. At times you listen to it, Teardrops on my Pillow or Coming Down. You listen to that and you think you're listening to The Pretenders. I would love them to team up with Susie Sue and do sort of the, to throw it back here, David Bowie and Queen type of team up, you know, that there used to be much more of in pop music. You don't really see that too much anymore. And Susie Sue hasn't done anything in ages. I don't even know the last thing they've done. Probably it's been 10 years at least. But I'd love for Susie Sue to come back, team up with them, do something. I don't know. It would just be great.
I do like that combination. I have to say it sounds intriguing, and I would be interested in hearing more about it, if that were to actually happen. But by the way, Susie Sue does have a solo career that's been going.
I must totally have missed me. I guess I only really knew her from Susie Sue and the Banshees, so...
Understandably, yeah, that's where 95% of the people know her from.
Oh. So, Reggie, what is your number two?
My number two team-up is... I'm just going to be blunt about it. Batman and Robin. Because you have this seemingly normal billionaire playboy by day, and then by night is this brooding rooftop-dwelling vigilante, and the boy wonder, you know, the the happy-go-lucky kid who's just happy to be a part of the action. And there's been a lot of different Robins over the years. All their stories in themselves are amazing. There's, you know, Jason Todd, Tim Drake, Stephanie Brown, even Damian Wayne now. And I really like the dichotomy just between the two of them. And I'm going to bring it up again, even though it's a sore subject for me and it makes me want to shake my fist at DC. But even the pairing of the of Damian as Robin, and then you had your wow, why am I blanking on his name?
Nightwing.
Yes, when he took over as Batman.
Dick Grayson.
And you guys can dock me for nerd points for forgetting, but their attitude switched. Batman was the brooding and mostly silent one, and Robin's the happy-go-lucky one, and with them it was switched, you know, since he was Robin and that was his personality. Batman was now the happy-go-lucky one, and considering that Damian is, you know, from this, you know, considering that Ra's al Ghul was his grandpa, he wasn't a very fun Robin. I'll just put it like that. So, I love the dichotomy between those two. I feel like there really hasn't been a better hero sidekick duo since they've got together. And, yeah, Batman and Robin.
I definitely agree that the new pairing of Dick Grayson and Damian Wayne. It's more intriguing than it is effective, in my opinion. It's just a little bit like, as far as maybe like if they did it as a one shot like or a limited like side series, that would be interesting. But Batman is just not Batman without Bruce Wayne to me. I mean, it's always on the personality of Batman is all about being on the edge of Bruce Wayne's personality and how much is it going to take him over, whatnot. But yeah, so that is a fantastic pairing though, and it says as much with the amount of people clamoring for Robin to appear in a Christopher Nolan film, which Christopher Nolan, without any sort of spoilers here or anything like that, he has said in the past, he was like, I'm not going to put Robin in a movie of mine.
Well, technically,
that's all I'm... Well, that's all we'll have to say about that. I don't want to get any further than that.
My personal favorite Batman and Robin team-up, though, has got to be George Clooney and Chris O'Donnell.
You don't get to talk anymore. You're done.
do I get kicked off the show if I admit that I actually watched that movie this past weekend?
Well, like, you can watch it, that's one thing, but did you enjoy it?
No, I had guests over and they wanted to watch it, and I, no.
Well, then you get to retain your status as a human being.
Okay. That's pretty.
You didn't even enjoy the bat nipples.
Oh, man. The bat credit card.
Stop.
Oh, so bad.
You're killing my soul.
Anyway, so good team up there otherwise. Chris, what's your number two?
Everybody chill. Anyway, my number two pick is Paul Newman and Robert Redford, otherwise known as Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, or, if you will, Henry Gondorf and Johnny Hooker from The Sting. Both those films are great films, and, of course, their two lead actors are great actors. So, the combo of the two makes me want to buy salad dressing more than anything else in the world. But it's also just a great, great, both are great, great films with some great, great performances in them. Butch Cassidy being probably my favorite of the two, but still, both are excellent films.
Yeah, excellent, excellent movies. Outright classics, I would say.
Indeed.
So my number two is sort of a more conceptual than any specific project. I would just love to see these two people work together on something. And I swear to God, I'm not a goth, especially after the last one, my Dum Dum Girls and Susie Sue, and this follow up, H.R. Geiger and Nine Inch Nails. Again, you know, I love Nine Inch Nails. I'm not a fan of industrial by and large. You know, I've listened to some of it in the past because, you know, Nine Inch Nails sort of makes you want to check it out. For the most part, not really my thing. I like their sort of pop culture sort of their sort of pop culture, or not pop culture, their sort of pop music rendering of those industrial sort of riffs and whatnot. And then H.R. Geiger is the famous artist. He is possibly most famous for doing the Alien in Alien. And Aliens, the Alien series. But he is actually a surrealist painter, sculptor, whatnot. All of his work is very organic, very fetishistic. Has a lot of, like, sex and skulls influenced in it. And I'm going to ignore the fact that he did design the microphone stand for Korn.
That thing is grotesque. Like, have you ever actually seen it?
I have no desire to see it. I'm just going to hope that if H.R. Geiger and Nine Inch Nails did something together, it would be more than that. I would love to see some sort of H.R. Geiger inspired movie that was scored by Nine Inch Nails. One of my sort of preemptive categories or how I was going to figure this out, I was not going to take team-ups that didn't ever happen, like the dream team-ups that were going to happen and then didn't, like Alejandro Jodorowsky and his adaptation of Frank Herbert's Dune that was going to be, like, art design by H.R. Geiger and what's his name? Dali, Salvador Dali, and was going to have Orson Welles in it, as well as Pink Floyd doing the music. Like, it was just going to be an insane collaboration. But it ended up not happening due to many different reasons. But I was not going to choose anything like that. However, I think that you get somebody like Nine Inch Nails, who's often talked about doing a Year Zero movie or miniseries or TV show of some sort. And every so often, you still hear that coming up. If you were to do some production design on H.R. Giger stuff, I think it would be a really interesting vision. Maybe not great. Like, depending on who took it, it could be pretty mediocre and just sort of more atmosphere than story, but I think it would still be at least interesting to watch.
How would you feel about H.R. Giger designing the next Nine Inch Nails album cover?
That would be interesting. Yeah, I would take that.
Good to know.
Is this happening? Do you have a hookup here, Chris?
No, nothing official yet.
Because Chris, if you have hookups here, like, that would be fantastic.
All I know is that Nine Inch Nails are recording new material, and whether or not what artwork that comes with it, I cannot say.
All right. Well, let's see what happens there. So that's my number two, H.R. Giger and Nine Inch Nails. Now for the big one. Reggie, what's your number one all-time team-up? And after having Pixar and Batman and Robin on your lists, I can only imagine what this one is.
My number one pick, it's actually two things that come from the earth that I want to shake this man's hand. I don't know who thought about this, but two things that come from the earth that when you smoosh them together and well, first you smash them individually.
I think I know where this is going.
And you put them together that it tastes magical. These two things, you actually use them as spreads upon bread and then put the bread together to form a sandwich. And these two things would be peanut butter and jelly. You can't see it, but I'm doing the dance right now. if there's ever like some huge funny and handsome guys party, Caitlin and I, we have this drink we call Classy Peanut Butter and Jelly. We make it, it's like a wine spritzer with like almond syrup, and it tastes fantastic. So if there's ever like some big funny and handsome guy soiree, we will have Classy Peanut Butter and Jellies for everyone to sample.
I think we need to make this happen just so I can try this. Yeah, I don't think you can get much better than that. Chris, what's your number one?
Well, I do want to say that personally, I tend to like peanut butter and chocolate a little bit more.
Ooh, yeah, that's one of those team-ups that you don't see coming. And then when it happens, it's like, holy crap, how did I not see this coming?
You got chocolate in my peanut butter.
You got peanut butter in my chocolate.
Peanut butter in my chocolate. Yep. Exactly. All right, so my number one team-up, classic movie team-up, Han Solo and Chewbacca.
Oh, that's... Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Of course. Star Wars trilogy. You know, two guys, best friends. And even though you can't understand a single word that Chewie is saying, you still know it's in the eyes, I think. You know, between Harrison Ford and Peter Mayhew, who plays Chewbacca. They're buddies. They will defend themselves to the end. And I think that's pretty, pretty important and classic in more ways than I can count. So that's my number one.
Do you know how they met? Like, I want to know how Han Solo met Chewbacca.
That would be a great prequel story that George Lucas failed to tell.
Well, it's definitely been told in one of the various extended universe type of stories that's been blessed by Lucas. On the other hand, have you guys seen the Han Solo Chewbacca end story that Indiana crosses over with Indiana Jones?
I have not seen that.
Reggie, have you heard about this?
No, but it sounds pretty ridiculous.
Okay, so there was a not connected in canon any sort of way at all. Like a lot of Star Wars stuff, they say it's not official canon, but it's you know, it's sort of blessed as an extended universe type thing. This right here is not even that far, but it's a comic book that came out in the early 90s where the end of it is basically Han Solo crashing on Earth or on a planet. And, yeah, it's super depressing. Basically what happens is, Han Solo dies after Chewbacca, like, kills a bunch of, like, Indians on this planet. And then years later, Indiana Jones, the last scene of it is Indiana Jones coming across this spaceship in the swamp and having the skull or the skeleton of Han Solo in it. So it's pretty depressing, but
I don't mean to get my nerd pants on, but technically, okay, here's why that can never happen. Star Wars exists in a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. If you were to be that far away and you looked at Earth, you'd be seeing dinosaurs. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh yeah, so, totally.
So by the time you But by the time Han Solo would get here, I wouldn't believe that
they
that
do have faster than light travel, though. That's a thing. Faster than light. So we don't know how fast that faster than light is.
I don't know. Science is still a little sketchy to me. I know it's science fiction, but. I believe that good science fiction has a solid base in reality.
Never mind the fact that Harrison Ford would, if there were a movie version, Harrison Ford wouldn't be able to play both roles, probably.
Probably. I don't know. It might be a better movie than Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skulls, though, anyway.
True.
I'd say watch it again. Watch it again. It wasn't so bad except for the ending.
No, it's pretty terrible.
He raped the series.
It's pretty terrible, Reggie. Terrible.
Well, it's a lot better than Batman and Robin, so I'd rather watch that
than Batman
and Robin any day.
Oh. All right, so my final number one, and it's really one that I have been holding out for years. I don't think it's ever going to happen, but holy crap, like, it seems too perfect to me not to. And that would be Terrence Malick and Cormac McCarthy. This is probably really pretentious and nerdy of me to, like, pull out these two guys. Terrence Malick is the famous, obtuse director of movies like The New World and most recently The Tree of Life. He's got a new movie coming out here soon. With, I believe, tying it all back together, Ben Affleck. And, it also, like, some of his earlier movies, Thin Red Line and Badlands. And then Cormac McCarthy of movies, or of books such as Blood Meridian and, No Country for Old Men and The Road. No Country for Old Men is a fantastic movie. The Road is an all right movie. I think I might have built myself up a little bit too much there for another too good to possibly be happening team up there, Cormac McCarthy and the director of The Proposition, whose name is currently escaping me. I'm going to cut all this out here. John Hillcoat. So the Rhodes adaptation seemed too good to be true to me. And I really think that Cormac McCarthy has never really done genre or true anything really violent. Like, some of his movies have contained violence in them, such as A Thin Red Line, having some violence in it, and specifically Badlands, which was his first film, which is about a killer in Nevada, loosely based off of a real-life killing spree that happened. But neither of those movies really, like, revels in the violence in any way, and I'm not asking for him to do that. But I think that Cormac McCarthy, his Blood Meridian is one of those great seminal works of literature, and having somebody as visionary and brilliant as Cormac, as Terrence Malick directing an adaptation of that, a movie that has often been talked about being made, like, again, too good to ever possibly happen for me, but somewhere in some random universe that movie exists, and it's most likely the most brilliant thing I've ever seen.
Well, the thing about that team-up is that Malick has never directed a film that he hasn't written himself.
It's true. And, I mean, Terrence Malick is... But, I mean... The Thin Red Line is based off of a book, as well as it's an old book by, I believe his name is James Jones or something like that. But The Thin Red Line was a movie back in the 50s or the 60s as well, based on the same book. So I mean, there's some precedent for it in that. We don't necessarily need something that would be literal from Terrence Malick, a literal adaptation of something. So.
Well, I do agree that them two, if they were to somehow work with each other or have some sort of, you know, Malick were to base some source material off of something McCarthy did or something of that nature, I think would be excellent.
So those are their top five dream team-ups. If you guys have any suggestions, anything we may have lost or missed over, or suggestions of your own, feel free to give us leave us a note on the blog or send us an email at fhgpodcast@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 847-893-0344. We've gone a little long again this week, but that's okay because I'm not paying for this server storage anymore. So.
Excellent.
But good show, guys, and we'll see everybody next week.
Absolutely.